Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
In the words from his website, Ruben Binns is an associate professor of human-centered computing, working between computer science, law, and philosophy, focusing on data protection, machine learning, and the regulation of and by technology. We sit down for an hour and talk about artificial intelligence from the theory of singularity to how it positively and negatively impacts our everyday life and society today. Ruben, just before we hit record, we started talking about how the communicating on the internet has changed, and we were saying how strange it is that we're doing, well, not strange, but we're using Discord to record a podcast, but we previously talked about Skype. You're well into computers, right? Is that a fair thing to say?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I don't know, I got given a word processor off my dad when I was little, which are those Amstrads. Do you remember those Amstrad computers that had background and green text?
What did you do with it?
I don't really know. Not a great deal, but I remember just enjoying, like, you know, messing around with whatever settings I could fiddle about with. You couldn't really do much on them, but yeah.
Is it literally the one with the black with the green text that would have a cursor that you would move?
Yeah. No mouse, just the arrows.
I remember those. I remember it, and I remember being fascinated by it. But my career path didn't lead me down a road that would end up at me being a professor of human-centered computing. What does that mean? At Oxford, no less.
They tend to like put particular titles on the sort of academic job spec. So mine is human centered computing, so that means rather than just looking at, you know, how we can build faster algorithms or, you know, more powerful computers, I also consider the sort of human elements of computers, so how they affect society, how they affect people, and how we can design them better so that they, you know, have the right values and interests of people in mind.
I want to start with the conversation. I've spoke to about four different people before recording this podcast about AI. What I wanted initially to speak to someone about was the idea of the singularity, the fact that there will be some sort of sentient AI that will be able to self-propagate and make decisions and understand its creation and understand what God is and why it was created and perhaps juggle with that. But all of you, every single person who works in this field, like, sighed as soon as it was, I could hear it. Even if they didn't actually sigh, I could hear the blood drain from their face, like, oh God, really? We want to have this conversation? What's wrong with that? What is wrong with that conversation for someone who understands AI in the way you do?
I think there's nothing wrong with the conversation in itself, because I think it reveals a lot about, you know, our fears, our hopes, our sort of dreams about whom we could be as humans in future, and what, you know, what it means to have a computer that could challenge our own sort of supremacy in the sort of in the hierarchy of the animal kingdom.
Mm.
But I think all that's interesting. But I think the reason why computer scientists would sigh is because they just probably all think that we're a long way from that. And the way that people who talk about that stuff as if it's going to happen are often coming at it with an agenda, whether that's because they're like a tech CEO who wants to get in more investment or wants to get people excited about their company, or if it's like people who don't really know about the technology but find it interesting to debate about the ethics of what if we had a Terminator. And I guess that's where the sighing comes from, because those conversations are not always, very productive to be having, especially when they're sort of a smokescreen for what else is going on, which is, you know,
what do you mean?
Using computers to decide, you know, who gets a job interview, or whether your benefits will be cut, or whether you'll get investigated for fraud or things like
we'll definitely come on to that. But just because I know people are going to be listening to this podcast and wanting to have this conversation first.
Yeah.
But so how realistic is it that there will be a piece of AI software that can self-propagate or develop itself? Will it happen in our lifetime? Will it happen in 100 years? Is it unlikely to ever happen? What's the school of thought from someone who genuinely understands AI?
Well, I guess, like, if you're just saying something that can self-replicate and get better, I mean, that already exists. We've got, like, malware that propagates. Do you remember when there was that... there was various malware that's like infected the NHS servers and infected, you know, loads of companies all around the world. And that's because it stalls on one computer and then starts trying to make connections to other computers. Mm. So you've got those kind of software that replicates itself and adapts. That's already a thing, but it's not conscious in the way that a human being or even
a
simple animal is. So I say, yeah, there's already that kind of thing. But in terms of like something that can think and reason and like have desires and like choose to, you know, try and take over the world, I think we're a very long way from that. And there's kind of, I guess, you could go into different reasons why that is. But if I can sort of outline some of the reasons why that's useful. So I guess to start with, there's kind of two strands of research in artificial intelligence. And also it's worth saying, like, artificial intelligence as a term is kind of difficult because it's always changing the goalposts. So every time, you know, there's something that computers can't do that humans can do, we say, oh, well, it'll be artificially intelligent when it can do X, and X might be playing chess. X might be playing chess to the level that can beat, you know, Garry Kasparov or, you know, the grandmasters. But as soon as you design a program that can do that, then suddenly everyone's like, oh, well, that's not real artificial intelligence.
Has that happened?
Yeah, I mean, so we've got chess playing computers that have beat the grandmasters.
Really?
But they're very specific. They're just a program that just plays chess. It can't do anything other than play chess.
Yeah, of course.
Play checkers.
So essentially, what it does is evaluate every possible move and just picks the best possible solution in that. And there's no way that a human being, there's no way a human brain can do just in that very specific task what that program's programmed to do.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's lots of like systems which would have been called AI before, which people would debate whether it's real AI or not, but that can do specific things that are better than a human could do. And that's been around for a while, but there's kind of this changing goalposts. We're always like redefining what it means to be AI. So if someone asks me what AI is, I just say, well, it depends like who you're asking when you're asking. But there's kind of one strand of research which sort of started in the 1950s. The idea was to model intelligence in the way that you would, you know, like arguments like, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man. So those are two facts. And then you can derive another fact from those two facts, which is that Socrates is mortal. because you can follow that chain of inference. So that's one type of AI, which is called like symbolic AI. And it's kind of then developed into like what they called expert systems, where they tried to get, you know, doctors or lawyers to say, well, what's all the stuff you know? Let's put that into a database and we'll come up with some rules about how you can combine bits of knowledge and then derive conclusions from it. And so that was popular in the sort of 80s. And then now what we've got is machine learning, which is this idea that rather than saying, here are the facts and the rules, and then design a program that can reason based on those facts and rules. Instead, we just show the computer loads and loads of data. That could be, you know, this is an image and it's of a cat. This is an image of it's a dog. And you just show the computer loads and loads of images of cats and dogs, and you label each image. And then you get the computer to figure out, based on all the images it's seen, like what combinations of pixels and colors and shapes mean that it's a more likely to be a dog versus a cat. And that's the sort of machine learning approach, which says we're not going to try and like decide for the computer what an ear is or what like a snout is. We're just going to give it loads and loads of data and it can figure out for itself how to distinguish between those kind of things.
So if you're showing it a picture of an ear, human ear, it's really looking at the pixels and the different shades in that pixel, something like that. Is that, or
yeah, at the basic level, the sort of the data that goes in, let's say it's a black and white image, each pixel or the image would be divided up into squares, and each square would have a number, and that number would basically mean it could be zero would be completely white and one would be completely black, and if it's somewhere in between, it's a number in between. So what the computer gets is just a series of numbers that describe what color each pixel is. But then it will build up from that. It will have sort of layers of understanding in the middle, which will be like, okay, well, three black pixels in a row is a line, for instance. And it just builds up gradually from that. It tries to build up the idea of different features.
I think for a lot of people, myself included, I think the idea that AI, it makes complete sense that you say that that's exactly what's happening, but it's less scary or exciting, depending on how you look at it, when I see a picture of an ear and my brain isn't doing it on a molecular level, it isn't doing it on a pixel by pixel base. It's just, I know what an ear is, my brain knows what an ear is, so therefore I can explain that.
Yeah.
Whereas for a computer, it's literally going back to, and it makes complete sense now you're saying it, but you did. What about the robots that they make humanoid forms and they're talking and someone's asking a question about what do you think? I can't remember the name of the. Do you remember the name of the robot? The girl. There's a girl talking. Sophia. Is it Sophia?
Yeah, I think so. That's one of them, anyway.
Yeah, and they're very creepy, and they've got given them human features in order to tap into the idea that this is a robot, and it's sort of they're trying to make it as human as possible. What is that? And the way you know they have journalists come on and talk to them and have a conversation, but what is that actual? Is that a program that's simply? What would you explain? Can you explain what that is? What they've done there?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing about those robots is there's basically two different kinds of technologies that are supposed to be working together. So one of them is basically like a really, really sophisticated Muppet in that it's got like, you know, they've put loads of work into making something that looks like a human face, muscles and everything. I don't really know about that.
The animatronics.
It looks cool.
It looks freaky. It's almost like they've made it intentionally rudimental.
Well, there's this theory, this Japanese roboticist who came up with this theory called the Uncanny Valley, which is the idea that if you have like a cute little robot that's just like a couple of lights that on their eyes and then like a little mouth that can make like a little, you know, smiley face.
Yeah.
That's like cute and we like it and we like interacting with it. But then the closer you get towards being really human realistic, it gets more and more creepy.
Yeah.
Until it's so there's this uncanny valley where we get this uncanny like creepiness feeling,
and they've been conscious of that and done that intentionally.
Yeah, I don't know why they do it, because I think some people think it's, I guess maybe people think, well, eventually it'll get so realistic that it won't be creepy anymore, because we don't know the difference.
Like Blade Runner.
Yeah, like Blade Runner. So I guess that's what they're thinking, but yeah, I don't know. But so the when they're talking to the robots, you could have a really realistic looking robot that might have a really crappy like speech interface. You could have one that had a really good speech interface, but a terrible physical manifestation of the face.
Yeah.
So I guess there's, you know, you kind of have to separate out those two things, and you might, you know, I think the Sophia one, I don't know exactly what the program was that was doing the conversation side of it, but you could kind of just plug in anything, like whatever the latest speech sort of chatbot interface is, you could put that into that robot and it would sort of, you know,
work.
Be the cutting edge of whatever's available at the time.
And what is that doing? If I ask a question of, you know, how has your day been to this program, how is it finding the answer?
So like the sort of most impressive chatbots today are based on what's called large language models. So what they are is, instead of like, you know, if you wrote a chatbot in the past, you might be like, okay, well, I'm going to figure out like what are the different types of questions people might ask, then figure out some stock responses, and then have like some randomization so it doesn't always say the same thing. That would be one approach. But the large language model approach is, it's a bit like the cats and dogs example. Instead of trying to come up with rules for language, we just feed the software as many examples of conversations as we possibly can. So they just scrape loads of data that could be like books, novels, film scripts, you know, posts on the internet, like Twitter, whatever. It could be anything. Feed that in and let the software model language based on all that data. So what it's doing is it's saying, well, if you see this word, think about all the other times you've seen that word and how close it was to other words in the language, and then figure out from that what's a plausible, or if you take a sentence level, because it might be a word level, it might be what they call bigrams, which is two words, or trigrams, three words, or it could be a whole sentence. And then you just figure out, well, what's the next most likely sentence or word based on everything it's ever seen before, which is, you know, more than a human could possibly ever remember. So it's basically just trying to replicate what it's seen in the past and what's like a likely thing that might be said next. So that's why it can appear really realistic, or really convincing that it's what a human would say. But it, sometimes you can see that it's actually failing because, so for instance, what people have found is that if you start typing in the beginning of a social security number, so social security number is like the national insurance number in the US.
Yeah.
Because lots of people have put in their social security number into the internet somewhere, and that software has like read all of that text. It knows, like, it's memorized some social security numbers. So if you start typing in a social security number, it might then think, oh, okay, this is a conversation I'm having. What's the next most likely thing? And it will finish off the social security number.
Right.
And that might actually be a real person's number.
Yeah.
So that just reveals that what it's doing is just kind of replicating what it's seen in the real world. It doesn't actually understand anything.
And like you said, that it might be quite easy, if you know what you're doing, quite easily to trick a chatbot. But how much work has gone into making them as effective as they are today? Is it decades of work, and everything that we see now is a product of the work that's gone before it? And is it a simple process in the modern day?
That's a good question. I mean, I think the thing that's made it much more effective in the last, I want to say, maybe 5 years, is just the move to just using loads and loads of data. So the basic sort of methods haven't changed that much. People proposed them a long time ago, but it's only recently that they've compiled all the data and got, you know, massive servers that are just crunching through all that data and creating these really large language models. And that's only really...
Is it open source? Is it people do this and just give it or put it up on the internet? Or,
well, that's a good question. They have So there's a company called OpenAI that do a lot of this stuff, and people are trying to figure out exactly where they get their data from, because they don't necessarily say. But it will definitely be, they would definitely include everything that's openly available on the internet. So, you know, Wikipedia, you know, film scripts on IMDb, I wouldn't be surprised. You know, there are some we haven't talked about yet, but there are some that do image generation. So you say, you know,
yeah, show I want me to talk about that.
So that's the same principle. And that's all based on, you know, remember Flickr? That was a website where people uploaded videos or photos. And it would just take all of them and use that as training data. So it's a bit vague exactly what they use, but I'm sure it includes everything that's public and probably stuff that's private as well.
So recently, certainly in the last 6 months, there's been this huge thing about AI image generation.
Yeah.
And this is there's like Discord servers that you can pay to have 20 different requests and images created, and then there's other websites that are free, but they're like, there's tons of ads and pop-ups and stuff. They know people are interested in them. But fundamentally, what you're asking is you put in some search terms, and then there is a program, an AI program, that creates an image based on what you've searched. So, you know, full disclosure, me and Ruben are both Spurs fans, right? We put in an image that would never be created, that would never exist. It's Harry Kane holding a salmon. And we got some interesting reports. I mean, they're strange, but we did fundamentally get what we asked for, which was a very strange image of a warped image of Harry Kane, but he was holding a salmon. What's happening there then? How have they made that from it not being a conversation and just becoming a image, a JPEG or whatever it might be?
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess the two elements there is that they've got lots of images of Harry Kane and they've got lots of images of people holding salmon.
Yeah.
So that's the like very simple answer, but
what's happening is in terms of like the how who created that and why does it exist?
So there's basically, imagine it's seen loads and loads of images, and it's got a basically almost a map of all the possible images that you could think of.
Mm.
It can kind of do something called interpolation, where it will sort of go to one space in its map, which is people holding a salmon, yeah, and then go to another space on the map, which is Harry Kane, and then sort of do the intersection of the two things. So it's the same way that they can do things like you've seen the ones that make someone have a like a crying face or a smiley face. So yeah, Arteta crying, exactly, is a common one. But it's doing the same thing. You're interpolating between the image of the person and then the idea of a smiling or crying. I guess the interesting thing there is that they have to go between the space of language to the space of images.
Yeah.
So it has to know what holding means. It has to know what salmon means. And so that's another bit of the puzzle that's recently been figured out, is how you...
Are you impressed by this stuff?
Yeah, I think it's really... It's amazing to see how much it can do, given how, in a way, simple it is. It's literally just give it loads and loads of data, and then it can generate stuff from that. That is quite impressive. I think the problem is that people then think, oh, it's got like consciousness, or it can do all this other stuff. And it's interesting to see like how easily it fails. So on the image one, there's these... If you sell it, give me a picture of a spoon in a cup, it'll do it, and it will give you loads of pictures that look realistic, like spoons in cups. Yeah. If you tell it, give me an image of a cup in a spoon, it's like...
There's nothing out there.
What to do. Yeah, there's nothing out there. So it just gives you images of spoons in cups, because it's like, well, spoon and cup, when they go together, this is how they go together.
Yeah.
Whereas a human could be like, oh, that's funny. I can try and imagine how a cup might fit in a spoon, and they could probably come up with something that would look weird but would be what you asked for. But the image generators have no concept of that, because they've never seen something like that.
That's interesting as well, is that, because like I can't imagine a cup in a spoon. I can't imagine. I don't know what my brain... I can imagine some sort of abstract artist could, but when I'm trying to sort of visualize something as abstract as a cup in a spoon, I can't actually do it, because I have no reference points. And there's like, it's an interesting sort of parallel, the fact that AI can't do it either.
Yeah, but then here's another example where AI can't do it and we can. So if you ask it, show me an image of a coffee cup with holes in it. If you think of a coffee cup with holes in it, it's not going to be full of coffee because it's got holes in it.
Of course. So if you empty cup.
Yeah, it would be an empty cup, maybe with a bit of coffee at the bottom.
Yeah.
When you ask the AI to do it, it comes up with coffee cup full of coffee, but also full of holes, which doesn't make sense. It's because it's got no concept of like gravity and objects containing other objects and water flows or coffee flows through holes. It doesn't have a concept of that, so it can't actually generate an image that corresponds to what you've.
Yeah. Have you heard of deep fakes?
Yes. Obviously. Yeah.
So there's AI going on there, right? I don't want to speak too much actually about it. I'm going to ask you what you think about deepfakes. Is it as scary as it seems, given the fact that you can literally make someone appear to be doing something they haven't done? And what is the sort of ethical sort of dropout from that?
Yeah, I'd say, like, having said previously that I think this, like, fears about killer Terminator AIs is like silly, I actually do think deepfakes are quite scary.
Yeah.
So, you know, lots of people talk about them as being scary because, well, what if someone like creates a deepfake of Joe Biden declaring nuclear war on Russia or something like that? That could happen, but like the more sort of near-term thing, which I think is probably going to happen, is people, so scammers, hackers, using deepfakes to scam people. I think that's definitely going to be an issue. So I've got a PhD student who's working on this. And so he's looking at how scammers at the moment will send out spam, right? So you get emails with spam and it's obviously spam. It's easy to see that it's spam. And then there'll be phishing attacks, which are like the same kind of thing, but some of them are targeted. So they'll be like, they won't just be sending out a generic thing to everyone that's the same. They'll be like, okay, I know this guy's called Flav. I know he works at this place. I know he's got these friends. How am I going to craft a phishing attack that's plausible that might sound like it's coming from someone he knows? And those are the two, you know, the first one's really cheap. You can send out loads and loads of spam messages to loads of people, or you can spend time as a hacker, like crafting the perfect phishing, like spear phishing attack.
Target one person.
Yeah, but what deepfakes allow is potentially you could automatically create very convincing either voice deepfakes, so you call someone up and it sounds like it's their mum.
Oh my God.
So you would like crawl
social media.
In principle it could exist. Yeah. So we haven't seen much of it yet, but there's no reason why, given current technology, we couldn't see it in the very near future.
Because there's things I've done and nights out I've had, but I can't remember. What I got up to. I'm pretty sure I was fine, but someone could suggest something that I'd done, and I couldn't plausibly say that didn't happen.
Yeah, and also just, yeah, so that would be like fooling you that you did something you didn't. But then, you know, your mum or your friends don't know it's not you when they get a call and it sounds just like you.
Yeah.
But what's crazy is they can replicate voices just with 20 seconds of your voice. So if they call you and you answer the phone, you say, "Who's this? Sorry, can't hear you. Okay, I'm going to put down the phone." That might be enough for them to clone your voice.
To what degree, though? So an entire conversation could be had and my mum wouldn't be able to tell that it wasn't me.
Yeah.
In principle, they could do that.
Yeah.
Fuck.
Yeah, it's terrifying.
What's being done to stop that kind of stuff? Anything?
I think there's people doing research on it, like this PhD student.
No, but all due respect to the PhD student, and I really hope he does a good job, or she does a good job.
Yeah.
But isn't the government doing stuff? Isn't that this?
I'm sure, you know, there's like people like the National Cybersecurity Centre. So that's the sort of the part of GCHQ that deals with securing businesses and companies. So it's not about like fighting against foreign intelligence agencies. It's about making sure that big companies have the right security in place. They're monitoring that kind of thing, but obviously it's they don't say everything that they're doing. So hopefully there are people there working on it.
But also they're not really going to care about like a domestic or sort of low-level phishing exercise. I mean, if it becomes such a massive problem, that they will.
Yeah.
But the idea that someone can do that and the technology in theory exists so that they could replicate a conversation and that my mum wouldn't know that it wasn't me. And that's scary for me because my voice, there's thousands and thousands of hours of me talking on the internet.
Yeah.
Stop nodding. It's... Stop nodding, Rube. Don't. I'm getting worried now. tell your PhD students, hurry up.
Yeah.
It's scary. That's crazy. The fact that no, it's not.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive and June. Olive and June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Lesser kind of, you know, when we're talking about deep fakes, you're thinking about, in my mind's eye, it's someone being put in a situation doing something that they shouldn't be doing, and then there'd be some sort of blackmail plot against them. But for it to actually be about replicating a conversation that you've had, what where are we going as a society where you can't trust the news, you can't trust tweets that you're reading because it may be some sort of Russian or Chinese bot farm where they're a troll farm or whatever it might be, and you can't even trust a conversation that you might be having with your mum. Like, what?
Yeah.
So that ethical, do you have to think about that, you know, the sort of ethical fallout of AI?
Yeah, and I think it's probably something that, you know, the people who came up with these fun, like, image generation AIs should have thought about. Maybe they did and they decided, fuck it, or maybe they decided it's worth it. You know, the downsides will be outweighed by the opportunities.
But isn't that human nature to just continue, just go on, forget about what the implications might be? Just keep creating, keep, you know, developing, and whatever happens will happen.
Yeah. I don't know. It might be that, obviously, you know, if it wasn't OpenAI or if it wasn't, you know, whoever came up with the latest one, it would be someone else. So maybe it's just inevitable, but I do think we need to be sort of thinking ahead about where these things are going. And that's one example where I would say people aren't worried enough, whereas most of the other ones about, you know, killer robots, I'm not too worried about. Yeah. But actually, no, maybe not killer robots. There's like, have you seen those robot dogs that have guns on them that the police have in I can't remember where it was. It was either the US or maybe Singapore or somewhere like that.
Not real, though. These are not real things.
I don't know.
Is that Boston Dynamics? Like, you know,
they're sort of... Yeah.
So, all right, I say that's interesting. Well, and I'm conscious of the fact that what you do for a profession isn't talking about all of these sort of doomsday, and there are real conversations to be had about how AI is implemented in everyday life. But with Boston Dynamics, they're creating robots that can navigate the real world and react to it. What's your opinion of that company and what they're doing?
I mean,
does it scare you? Because it's only a matter of time before it's implemented into a war zone. Yeah.
And I suppose if the scenario is, well, it's two, you know, superpower nations in a war, and they both have robot dogs, and the robot dogs are killing each other, at least that's not humans dying. But realistically, it's not going to be that. It's going to be, you know, a superpower invading a poor country and using robot dogs to kill poor people in poor countries.
And what's weird about it is that they're using drones now, which are probably more effective than robot dogs. But robot dogs are so much more sort of they exist in the psyche of you know, just everybody. Like the idea of a robot dog coming in unannounced, no understanding of law. Or and coming into your house and holding a gun. Do you remember there's this film Tom Selleck was in? I can't remember what it's called. It was like there was these little sort of machine spiders that would come and inject people. And I can't remember what it was. And I'll post it in the link to the link to the podcast. But fundamentally, it was an 80s film. And it was that exact same thing. Was the police were using robots to infiltrate houses with impunity, pretty much. Anyway, I don't know where I'm going with this, but the fact is that there's the idea that these superpowers are creating robots that can be used as instruments of war, and then there's sort of elements of AI involved. It's like huge sort of ethical boundaries that are being broken. Your work. I don't know how much this infiltrates your work, but how would you say AI works generally in our everyday lives? How are we being impacted? If you forget all of the, you know, crazy stuff that we've been some of the stuff, the crazy stuff we've been talking about. How does AI influence our lives generally today?
I suppose. There's a bit of like retrospective retroactive like use of the word AI for stuff that already existed before it was called AI. So a lot of companies now are just using AI to refer to, you know, statistical models.
Yeah.
So if we take that sort of slightly broader perspective, you know, there's AI being used to sort through job applications, for instance. So if you apply for a job now,
like Amazon or something like that?
Amazon was one of the famous examples, but I think all the big companies are doing it now. Any company that's got, you know, thousands of positions.
What are they doing?
So basically they're doing things like scanning CVs and application letters and automatically scoring the applicant based on that. So if you don't have certain things that they're looking for in the CV, it will give you a lower score, and then you might not get an interview. So even if you're actually a good candidate, if the computer has decided you're not a good enough candidate to interview, you won't even get an interview. And also that is often the way they've trained those systems is based on, well, who did we hire in the past and who did we turn down? And what were their CVs like? And then we use that to train the model to score the new CVs. Now, what that means is if you're an industry that's historically been discriminating, been a hostile place for women or people of color, you're going to end up replicating that same bias in your selection process.
So someone puts, if they're female or if they're African or whatever it might be, that there will be a systematic bias against those people.
And it's usually not explicit. It's not like they have a field in the application form saying, are you a woman or are you black? But it's more subtle. So it'll be, because the world is you know, segregated and structured in sort of unequal ways, there'll be all kinds of things, even if you don't say that you're a woman or you're black, that will show up in your CV in various ways. It might be the school you went to. In the US, you've got sort of historically black colleges, or women-only colleges. So if you've got that on your CV, and it's a company that previously only hired men, it's unlikely that you're going to get through that initial hiring.
But is that the company pre-setting those parameters?
No, not explicitly, because what they're doing is they might have, they're not like, well, here's the features we're going to consider. We're going to tell the system to judge based on these things. It's literally, here's a whole CV with loads of words in it, and here's, you know, 10,000 other CVs with words in. Figure out what combinations of words correlate with job success. And so the system is sort of let loose to figure out all that stuff. And so some of the patterns it figures out will be reflecting discrimination rather than being good for the job. So that's how it's so no one's explicitly telling it to do that, but that's what it's figuring out.
And is this a system that, say, someone like Amazon or another massive company, like, forget Amazon, let's not use them as an example, but that a huge company, do they buy this off the shelf and then just implement it, and who's creating that?
Yeah, there's companies that specialize in this kind of software. So there's companies like Pymetrics, HireVue, and there's a few others that sort of pioneered this software. And so, you know, big companies will buy those solutions in and use them to filter out candidates. Some companies will do it in-house. So Amazon, for example, they have this sort of news story, which I've always been a bit suspicious about, but the news story was that Amazon designed a system to do this themselves for their own software engineer hiring processes. And then they realized that it was discriminating, so they didn't use it, which is, like, I guess, a kind of good PR for Amazon.
How long did it take them? A year to realize that this is discriminatory?
I don't know. They didn't say. It all came out at the same time. It was like, we were going to do this thing, but look how responsible we are. We figured out we shouldn't do it, so we didn't.
Is there an argument, though, that like a piece of AI that has no emotion, it doesn't understand politics, doesn't understand the world, will simply pick the best candidate for the job? Is that something that's being talked about?
So that is, like, that's often what people assume, because it's mathematics. It's just looking at data. There's no human bias involved. But the problem is, if you're doing the sort of statistical approach to AI, which is just looking at patterns in the past, and those patterns in the past are reflecting human choices about who to hire and reflecting human decisions about whether to rate an employee as successful or not. So if it's a sexist work culture and the management reviews people's progress and the managers that are doing those performance reviews are sexist, then the data that you feed into the machine is going to reflect the same thing. Yeah. So the maths might be neutral in a sense, but it's picking up on the human patterns and then accurately, neutrally, scare quotes, replicating those patterns. So it's easy to think, like, computers are neutral, computers are objective, but in this kind of context, it's not really the case.
Do you think that AI overly is a positive thing in our modern society, or is it something that needs to be checked, or is that too much of a simple question? It's not as binary as that. What's your opinion?
No, I think it's a fair question, because what I'd say about it is there's so many things that are wrong with society that if you build AI in modern society and it's driven by profit motive, it's driven by how can we cut costs or how can we earn more. It's not driven by, you know, how can we alleviate poverty or how can we, you know, create a more equitable society. Then it's obviously going to reflect the values of the sort of industries that create it. So in theory, in another world where things were, you know, better, maybe AI would be a force for good. But in the current society we live in, I think it's almost inevitably going to be bad. That's not to say there's some cool stuff, and like, you know, you can have fun with the image generation, and there might be some cool like scientific uses of it. You know, weather prediction is kind of a good thing. Like, no one really is harmed by better weather prediction. So there are definitely some good sides to it, but I think overall the way it's used in society will reflect the values of the society we have.
Is that because, I think you sort of alluded to it there, is that the its development is going to be funded where the money is, and the motive of a company or a country that's essentially better in their own eyes because of they can generate more income, that the AIs are going to be developed to perpetuate that rather than it for being used for social good, because there's a reflection of an idea that socialism is bad, and capitalist companies will you know, they'll fundamentally invest in something that's going to support their business model.
Yeah, exactly. And I think like it's interesting to think about it in the context of just automation generally. So if you think about all the things that have been brought in to automate aspects of labor, whether that's, the automatic, what we call the loom, so people weren't sewing with their hands anymore, that displaced labor in a way that, in theory, it could be better because we don't have to spend loads of time like knitting clothes anymore.
Yeah.
But what it actually did was, create working conditions that were actually quite dangerous. It gave more control over the production process to bosses. And the same thing happens with AI. It might not be that it actually improves processes. It might not be that we end up hiring better people or finding more instances of fraud or, having more dynamic markets and prices. It might just be that the purpose of it is to concentrate control. So that would be my, if you asked another computer scientist, they probably wouldn't say all this stuff, but because I'm a bit of a lefty, that's probably my angle on it.
Do you know anything about how AI might be used in sport and performance, and in specifically in football?
That's a really interesting question. I know there was a big case, actually. I should go and look and see what happened with this, but there was a case a few years ago where a bunch of Premier League players started a legal case because all the analytics companies were basically creating profiles of them, which I'm sure you've seen. Anyone who's like even slightly football nerd will see that any player you want to look at, even in a lower league, you'll be able to see all their stats. But these Premier League players, they don't just have that. They've got also like very intimate data about their bodies. That's like their heartbeat.
This is the machine that the club can track at their performance, basically how far they're running and how their body's reacting to the stresses that they've been put under.
Exactly. Yeah. So all
So what's the issue there? Was it, are they saying it's intrusive?
I think the case was like basically saying, look, this is data about us. We should have a say in how it's used. It's not just the sole ownership of the club or of the analytics company. I don't know what actually happened to it, but it was an interesting reaction to this development of sort of analytics, sort of very, not just the analytics of, this team beat that team, but like intimate details about an individual. I guess I've got a bit less sympathy because they're paid so much, but still, it's an interesting test case because I'm sure in future, all of us, even if we're just, ordinary people with ordinary salaries, will be increasingly expected to give away that kind of data to our employers for all kinds of reasons.
Well, what might AI give Tottenham Hotspur as a company? What information? How would they use it? I guess
I'm sure there'll be people who actually know about sports science. I'm definitely not one of them who could probably tell you more, but I'm sure there's lots of things you could tell from that. I'm sure you could predict you know, the relationship between, you know, sleep and performance, and, you know, predict when a particular player should be subbed because they're about to, you know, run out of energy. Mm. Yeah, I'm just speculating though.
So. Fair enough. So one of the most impressive things I've ever experienced, certainly in recent years, but probably my entire life, is how good the TikTok algorithm is.
Mm.
So I've never, if I linger on, and anyone who's listened to this who uses TikTok will 100% understand what I'm talking about. But I'm using it in real time, and if I linger on a video, it's just slightly longer than I would have done the other videos that I've been served. I'll suddenly, the algorithm will kick in and give me more of what I've just asked for. We're talking like split seconds. What's your opinion of the TikTok algorithm, and not necessarily whether it's good or bad, but how impressive is it?
Yeah, I don't actually use TikTok.
Don't use it. It's so addictive. You get stuck in it, honestly.
I sort of end up like seeing TikToks that people post on other things.
Yeah.
But I do sort of have I did do some testing of it when it was in like 2017 or 2016 when it was called Musical.ly.
And I remember, right. Yeah, it was called that. Yeah.
Addictive. But I guess the difference between the TikTok algorithm and let's say Netflix algorithm, the thing about the way you use Netflix, the algorithm has to learn from what you do, and it only learns when you take an action in relation to a piece of content in this case.
Yeah.
So with Netflix, you might watch a film and you get to the end of the film and you're like, oh, well, that was shit. But Netflix has learned nothing.
Yeah, they won't know how you feel about it.
The same amount of time it took you to watch a film, TikTok, if you're just on TikTok for an hour and a half, you've already given TikTok loads and loads of information because you've like skipped a video or stayed on a video. So you're just giving them way more behavioural signals. So I think that's one of the reasons, probably other reasons as well, but that's one of the main reasons why it's so much more compelling than the other algorithms.
It's just it's like supremely functional. It just works, and I'm sitting there completely complicit in that. And all right, I did like that video. I want more of it, and I'm 41. Like I've got stuff to do. And I'm sitting on my sofa and get locked into it for an hour or two. I've never experienced anything like it. And I know what's happening. I understand that that there's an AI involved, an algorithm involved, and it's controlling me. And I know that's the case. And I'm willfully, like I say, complicit in what's happening. How do you, that can't be a good thing.
Yeah, I think it is kind of scary to see how addictive these things can be. But I suppose one of the problems is that it's just purely based on behavior. So you never get a chance to say to TikTok, okay, give me a break, give me half an hour to like reflect on myself and reflect on like the last 10 hours of stuff I've watched and figure out, and tell, they don't give you a chance to tell them, look, I sort of wish that I hadn't spent all this time looking at this thing or that, you know, looking at this particular, like, whatever genre of TikTok it is. So they never get that signal. All they get is your behavior. Now, obviously, the reason they don't want you to reflect on that is because they want to keep you engaged.
Hmm.
But you could imagine in the future you'd have systems that would try to... Oh, thank you. You'd have systems that would like try and take into account that other kind of information. So, you know, what, not just what you do in the moment, but what you feel about that later on. So if you actually regret all that time you spent on that platform, that could factor it in and be like, next time you end up going down a rabbit hole, it could be like, you want to take a break? You know, maybe you don't want to do this right now.
Yeah, no, I get it. It's scary when you think about it too much, and TikTok doesn't want you to think about it too much. They just want you to react to what they're doing. So just before, you know, we're moving towards the end of this conversation, but I'm interested in what you're teaching and what you're talking about when you you know university and what your students are up to. What are you doing? Like what kind of conversations are you having? What have you talked about today?
So I guess I sort of do. Some of my time is spent doing just research. So like, you know, building things, testing them out, seeing what people.
Are you lecturing?
Yeah, and then the other half of, well, not even half, like less than half of my time is teaching. That's teaching sort of lectures. So people come in and I give them a lecture. If anyone's been to uni, they'll sort of understand what that's about. There's also like supervision where you've got one-to-one sort of meetings with students who are developing their own research. So I'm sort of guiding them through that as well. And I quite enjoy the teaching side because most of my students are mature students. So they have their full-time job and they are trying to learn in their spare time, do a master's. So I learn a lot from them because they have a lot of real world experience, unlike, you know, sort of 18 year olds who just come from school,
yeah,
who are fine as well, but they, you know, they don't have as much world experience.
They want to know about the Terminator.
Yeah, exactly.
do you come across students that really like her, that are inspiring, that they're doing things that are going to make a significant impact on how AI works or how it should be regulated or what the ethical boundaries of what that might entail?
Yeah, definitely. There's definitely some students that have done really interesting research and are really smart. Problem is, a lot of them end up going to work at Google or Facebook or other big tech companies, and then you never hear from them again because right. They're like, you know, they understand all the reasons why current technology has got risks and got problems.
But there's money to be made at Google.
Yeah, well, hopefully they'll be trying to change, you know, what's going on from the inside. But yeah, that's the reality.
Would you think that Google is a force for good or a force for bad?
I'd say on balance at the moment, it's a force for bad.
Why?
But, you know, I've definitely been, I guess you could say I'm hypocritical in that I definitely use a lot of Google products.
Everybody does. You can't avoid it. But yeah. why are they a force for bad?
So their tagline is, their tagline used to be, don't be evil. And then at some point, I think maybe 5 or 6 years ago, they decided, nah, we're not going to have that one anymore. Because what if we want to be evil?
What do you mean the tagline was bad, don't be
that
evil?
Was like that was like their company motto. It was like, I think maybe someone asked them, you know, what's your corporate social responsibility? And they're like, don't be evil. And then later on, they regretted it because they thought, oh, maybe we do want to be a bit evil sometimes.
Well, what are Google and Facebook doing in terms of AI? How are they developing it and how are they pushing it forward?
Well, they've got some of the biggest AI research kind of teams, and they've got huge amounts of resources that universities don't have. So it used to be that, you know, AI research was, you know, conducted by the private sector, but mostly driven by academic researchers who were, you know, funded by governments to do work that's, you know, scientific work in the public interest, and to develop the field, and then that can then be commercialized. What you've got now is companies like Google and Facebook and others. They're the ones that have the best computing infrastructure. So to train these big AI models, you need loads and loads of computers and loads of energy. So actually there's quite a big carbon footprint, and you know, you need loads of electricity, computing power to produce these things. And so only, you know, the Googles, the Facebooks, the Microsofts have the actual money and power to do that stuff. And so that just means that these cutting edge AI systems, even if they were completely benevolent, it's not great that they're completely controlled by these private companies, because they get to decide, you know, when to release them, what to do with them. And if you want to do cutting edge research, you kind of have to partner with them, with those companies. So it's a bit of a tricky situation for AI research to be in, I think.
What if So Facebook and Google are a part of Western ideals and technology. What's happening in China and Russia as an equivalent?
Yeah, so China is definitely also one of the big players. So there's companies like Baidu, Huawei.
We're kind of aware of them, but they're not like no one would talk about sort of Google and Facebook in the same breath as those. But how significant are they?
Yeah, they're definitely significant, and also you get a lot of sort of revolving door between people working at Google and Facebook, and then working certainly in the research side of things.
Is there a working relationship between the companies? It's not like as frosty as it seems politically.
Yes and no. They're kind of, in some ways they're enemies, but in other ways they kind of work together on some things. Interestingly though, like for instance, my university will not allow us to work with Huawei because of national security concerns.
Yeah, this so is something that was
like geopolitical.
The highest level though, that is, in which, remember there was a deal, was it? I can't remember. Maybe it was Boris Johnson came out. I can't remember what it was, but Hawaii, it was a phone manufacturer, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And there were security issues with that and risks of that. So.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a fascinating thing, and I'm not sure. I mean, I could talk about this all night, but I'm conscious of keeping taking too much of your time. Ruben, thank you so much for sharing all this information. It's been lovely and a really interesting chat, and we'll see. See what happens with AI.
Yeah, I'm terrified, but I'm terrified as well.
Okay, all right. I'll ask you one final question: is when you're going to bed at night and you're getting into bed and it's the most comfortable and safest place in the world for you, what keeps you up, if anything?
I don't know. I think luckily I managed to keep most of this out of my sleeping sort of state for now.
So you're cool. You're all right.
I put my head down and I just sleep and then wake up at 7 a.m. every day. Sleeping has never been an issue, but definitely my waking hours, this definitely occupies a lot of my time.
That is a mark of a psychopath, just so you know. Someone can just knowing what you know and sleeping. <It's unreal. laughs> Ruben, thank you so much, mate.